And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is May 3rd. On the 23rd day of the year. 242 days remain till the year's over with. The war in Ukraine is still raging. Nancy Pelosi went there to straighten things out, since she's all-powerful in her mind. Didn't work out that way, though. 752, the Mayan king, Bird Jaguar IV of Yaxchilan in modern-day Chiapas, Mexico, assumes the throne. 1481, the largest of three earthquakes strikes the island of Rhodes and causes an estimated 30,000 casualties. 1491, Congo monarch Nkuyu Nzinga, baptized by Portuguese missionaries, adopted the baptismal name of Joao I. There's nothing so well established that we can't screw up with religion. 1568, angered by the brutal onslaught of Spanish troops at Fort Caroline, a French force burns San Mateo Fort and massacres hundreds of Spaniards. In 1616, the Treaty of Loudun ends a French Civil War. In 1715, a total solar eclipse is visible across Northern Europe, Northern Asia, is predicted by Edmund Halley within 4 minutes accuracy. 1791, the Constitution of May 3rd, the first modern constitution in Europe, is proclaimed by the Sejm of Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. 1802, Washington, D.C. is incorporated as a city after Congress abolishes the Board of Commissioners, the district's founding government. City of Washington is given a mayor-council form of government. 1808, Finnish Civil War. Sweden loses the fortress of Sveaborg to Russia. 1808, Peninsular War. The Madrid rebels who rose up on May 2nd are executed near Principio Hill. 1815, Napoleon War. Joaquin Murat, the King of Naples, is defeated by the Austrians at the Battle of Tolentino, the decisive engagement of the war. 1830, the Canterbury and Whitstable Railways opened. It's one of the first steam haul passenger railway to issue season tickets and include a tunnel. 1837, University of Athens is founded in Athens, Greece. 1848, the boar-crested Anglo-Saxon Bente Grange helmet is discovered in a barren Bente Grange farm in Derbyshire. 1849, the May Uprising in Dresden begins. That's the last of the German revolutions of 1848-1849. Excuse me. 1855. American adventurer William Walker departs San Francisco with about 60 men to conquer Nicaragua. 1901, the Great Fire of 1901 begins in Jacksonville, Florida. 1913, Raja Harishchandra, the first full-length Indian feature film, is released, marking the beginning of the Indian film industry. 1920, Bolshevik coup fails in the first Democratic Republic of Georgia. 1921, Ireland is petitioned under British rule by the Government of Ireland Act in 1920. It creates Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland. 1921, West Virginia becomes the first state to legislate a broad sales tax, but it isn't implemented until a number of years later due to enforcement issues. 1928, the Jinan incident begins with the death of 12 Japanese civilians by Chinese forces in Jinan, China, which leads to Japanese retaliation and the deaths of over 2,000 Chinese civilians in the few days following that. 1939, the All India Forward Bloc is formed by Netaji Subhas and Chandra Bose. 1942, World War II, Japanese naval troops invade Tulagi Island and the Solomon Islands during the first part of Operation Mo that results in the Battle of the Coral Sea between Japanese forces and forces from the U.S. and Australia. Battle of the Coral Sea was one of the major naval battles. Battles historically significant as the first action which aircraft carriers engaged each other and the first in which the opposing ships never saw or fired directly on one another. Although it was a victory for the Japanese in terms of ships sunk, the battle proved to be a strategic victory for the Allies in a number of ways. First time since the start of the war that the Japanese fleet carriers Shokaku and Zukaku, the former damaged and the latter with a depleted aircraft complement, were unable to participate in the Battle of Midway the next month. But Yorktown participated on the Allied side, which made for rough parody of aircraft. You know, and the sad thing about it, you can win the battles and lose the war, which is pretty much what the Japanese did. World War II, sinking of the prison ships Cap Arcona, Thielbeck, and Deutschland by the Royal Air Force in Lubbock Bay took place on this date. 1947, new post-war Japanese constitution goes into effect. 1948, U.S. Supreme Court rules in Shelley versus Kramer that covenants prohibiting the sale of real estate to blacks and other minorities are legally unenforceable. It's interesting to note that in the paperwork for Biden buying his mansion, Jews were prohibited. But why should the law stand in the way of something our Lord and Master wants? 1951, London's Royal Festival Hall opens with the Festival of Britain. Also in 51, U.S. Senate Committee on Armed Services and the United States Senate Committee on Foreign Relations begin their closed-door hearings on the relief of Douglas MacArthur by President Truman. They cannot stay out of anything. 1952, Lieutenant Colonels Joseph Fletcher and William Benedict of the U.S. land a plane at the North Pole. 1952, the Kentucky Derby is televised nationally for the first time on CBS. 1957, Walter O'Malley, the owner of the Brooklyn Dodgers, agrees to move the team from Brooklyn to Los Angeles. 1963, the police force in Birmingham, Alabama, switches tactics and responds with violent force to stop the Birmingham campaign protesters. Images of the violent suppression are transmitted worldwide, bringing newfound attention to the civil rights movement. And quite often, things like that are instigated by the protesters to get photos they can use to support their position. Now, that's not to say the police were totally correct. They weren't. 1968, 85 people are killed when Braniff International Airlines Flight 352 crashes near Dawson, Texas. 1971, Erich Honecker becomes the first secretary of the Socialist Unity Party of Germany, remaining in power until 1989. 1978, the first unsolicited bulk commercial email, which later became known as spam, sent by Digital Equipment Corporation marketing representative to every ARPANET address on the west coast of the U.S. 1979, Margaret Thatcher wins the United Kingdom general election. Next day, she becomes the first female British prime minister. 1986, 21 people are killed and 41 are injured after a bomb explodes on Air Lanka Flight 512 at Colombo Airport in Sri Lanka. 1987, a crash by Bobby Allison at the Talladega Super Speedway in Alabama. Fencing at the start-finish line would lead NASCAR to develop a restrictor plate for the following season, both at Daytona International Speedway and Talladega. 1999, a southwestern portion of Oklahoma City is devastated by an F5 tornado, which killed 45, injured 665, and caused $1 billion in damage. Tornadoes went to 66 from the 1999 Oklahoma tornado outbreak. Also produces the highest wind speed ever recorded, measured at 301 miles per hour. 1999, infiltration of Pakistani soldiers on the Indian side results in the Kargil War. 2000, the sport of geocaching begins with the first cache placed in the coordinates form a GPS posted on Usenet. 2001, the U.S. loses its seat on the U.N. Human Rights Commission for the first time since the commission was formed in 1947. And at that point in time, I would have shown the U.N. the door. You love the abuser so much, go put your headquarters with them. 2006, Armavia Flight 967 crashes into the Black Sea near Sochi International Airport in Sochi, Russia. Kills 113 people. 2007, a 3-year-old British girl, Madeline McCann, disappears in Praia da Luz, Portugal, starting the most heavily reported missing person case in modern history. She still has not been found, although German prosecutors do believe she is dead. She was on holiday in the UK with her parents and her 2-year-old twin siblings and a group of family friends and her children. She and her twins fell asleep at 10:30 in the evening on the ground floor apartment when McCann's and friends dined in a restaurant 180 feet away. Parents checked on the kids throughout the evening until the mother discovered Madeline was missing about 11 o'clock. Over the following week, particularly after misinterpreting a British DNA analysis, the Portuguese police came to believe Madeline died in an accident in the apartment and her parents covered it up. The parents got suspect status in September 2007, which was lifted when Portugal's Attorney General archived the case in July 2008 for lack of evidence. So the question becomes, what happened to Madeline? 2015, two gunmen launch an attempted attack on an anti-Islam event in Garland, Texas, which was held in response to the Charlie Hebdo shooting. That's when terrorists attacked the Charlie Hebdo offices because they published cartoons that made fun of the prophet. 2016, 88,000 people evacuated from their homes in Fort McMurray, Alberta, Canada, as a wildfire rips through the community. Destroys about 2,400 homes and buildings. Okay, let's see what else we got. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays observances, National Feast Day, Abhai in the Syriac Orthodox Church, Antonian Alexander, Juvenal of Narni, Mura in the Coptic Church, Philip and James the Lesser, Pope Alexander I, Sarah the Martyr in the Coptic Church, the Most Holy Virgin Mary, Queen of Poland, Theodosius of Kiev in the Eastern Orthodox Church, Constitution Memorial Day in Japan, Constitution Day in Poland. Finding the Holy Cross related observances on this date, which includes the Fiesta de la Cruces in Spain, Hispanic America, and it's World Press Freedom Day. Let's see what else we got. Okay. BC, solar eclipse seen at Ugarit by Mesopotamian astronomers. On the day of the new moon in the month of Iyar, the sun was put to shame and went down in the daytime with Mars in attendance. 1294, John II becomes Duke of Brabant and Limburg. Excuse me. 1342, Count Hartmann II becomes ruler of Vaduz, which you know as Liechtenstein. I've been there. Nice little place. 1382, Battle of Beverhoutsville near Bruges in modern-day Belgium. The army of Ghent beats a drunken Bruges militia. 1491, I talked about that. 1512, Pope Julius II opens the Fifth Council of Lateran and St. John Lateran Basilica in Rome. Julius II was known as the warrior pope, always sending folks out to get killed. He never went himself. 1558, Ferdinand I officially appointed Holy Roman Emperor after his brother Charles abdicated in 1556. 1621, statesman and philosopher Francis Bacon is accused of bribery. There are many people that said he was actually wrote what is credited to Shakespeare. 1624, Spanish silver fleet sails to Panama. 1629, French Huguenot leader Duc de Rohan signs the accord with Spain. 1640, English upper house accepts the act of attainder. 1654, the bridge at Rowley, Massachusetts begin charging tolls for animals. 1660, Sweden, Poland, Brandenburg, and Austria sign the Peace of Olivia. 1661, Johannes Hevelius observes the third transit of Mercury ever to be seen that we know about. 1662, there's a royal charter granted to Connecticut. 1678, the French conquer the fleet at Curacao. 1200 die. 1715, Edmund Halley observed the total eclipse phenomenon known as Bailey's Beads. 1747, Wilhelm IV appointed Viceroy of Holland in Utrecht. 1808, the day depicted by Spanish painter Goya in his The Third of May is painted in 1814. 'Whatever this nasty thing is I've got, it is not COVID, it is a cold. 1810, English poet Lord Byron swims the Hellespont, which is modern-day Dardanelles. 1822, Society for the Propagation of the Faith, founded in Lyon, France. 1837, University of Athens is founded. 1841, New Zealand proclaimed a colony independent of New South Wales. 1845, first African-American lawyer, Macon Allen, admitted to the bar in Massachusetts. 1845. Fire kills 1,600 in a popular theater in Canton, China. 1846, Mexican Army begins the siege of Fort Texas near Brownsville during the Mexican-American War. In 1851, the sixth major fire in San Francisco destroys 1,500 to 2,000 buildings. 1855, Antwerp-Rotterdam Railway opens up. 1860, Charles XV of Sweden-Norway is crowned King of Sweden. 1861, General Winfield Scott presents his Anaconda Plan to Lincoln for the North against the South, the American Civil War. Winfield Scott was the Supreme Commander. 1861, Lincoln's asked for 42,000 Army volunteers and another 18,000 for the Navy. 1863, the Battle of Salem Church in Virginia took place. Also in 63, the Second Battle of Fredericksburg occurs in Virginia, part of the Chancellorsville Campaign of the American Civil War. 1864 saw the third day of battle in Alexandria, Louisiana, with a Confederate assault. 1867, Hudson Bay Company gives up all its claims to Vancouver Island. 1886, M.A. McLean, elected the first mayor of Vancouver, British Columbia. 1898, Camp Merriman performs at the Presidio in San Francisco. 1901, a fire destroys 1,700 buildings in Jacksonville, Florida. 1906, British-controlled Egypt takes Sinai Peninsula from Turkey. 1916, Irish nationalists Patrick Pearse, Thomas McDonagh, and Thomas Clark are executed by firing squad following their involvement in the Easter uprising. 1919, Afghanistan Emir Anamullah begins war against Great Britain. 1923 saw the first nonstop North American transcontinental flight, New York to San Diego. It was completed on this date. 1926, on this date, Britain's Trade Union Congress calls for the country's first ever general strike. Begins 1 minute to midnight in support of striking coal miners. It lasted 9 days. 1926, the Marines landed in Nicaragua 9 months after they left, stayed until 1933. 1929, Prussia banned anti-fascist. 1932, 24 tourists begin the first air charter holiday, London to Basel, Switzerland. 1933, Nellie Ross, the first female director of the U.S. Mint, takes office. 1937, Margaret Mitchell wins the Pulitzer Prize for Gone with the Wind. 1938, the concentration camp at Flossenbürg goes into use. 1938, the Vatican recognized Franco, Spain. And in 1941, there was a German air raid on Liverpool. And on that note, we have come to the end of our little history segment. You know, we've been talking about a lot of off-the-wall things. And certainly, we do live in a very strange world. There's no question about that. You know, we've been talking about some of the affiliated discoveries to the Lewis and Clark expedition. You know, one of the reasons for the expedition was to determine, was there another affiliated, unaffiliated civilization coexisting with us on this continent. And, of course, there was evidence found that if it wasn't in existence now, it was. 1963, a construction engineer found a stockpile of coins while excavating on the northern bank of the Ohio River. They were together in a clump in the remains of a disintegrated leather pouch. The discoverer, of course, as most folks who find treasure did, kept it secret, but he gave away two of the coins to a friend who was also an engineer. And 30 years later, that engineer's widow brought those two coins to the Falls of the Ohio Museum in Clarksville, Indiana. Museum's curator, Troy McCormick, identified one of the coins as a bronze coin that depicted Claudius II. It's issued in 268 A.D. The other coin examined by Mark Lehman, an expert in ancient coins and president of Ancient Coins for Education Incorporated. He said it was a phallus of Maximinus II from about 300 A.D. Now, the interesting thing is there's an old, old story about a Roman colony that was formed right outside of Phoenix, I think. And they explored a lot of North America. Now, the museum had the coins on display for a number of years till it was informed by the state of Indiana the exhibit conflicted with the state's archaeological policy. There was no documented evidence of the pre-Columbian American contacts. I mean, Lewis and Clark didn't find any Roman coins on their journey, but they definitely walked a path that had been traveled by a rainbow of ancient people. Now, the Corps of Discovery got back to St. Louis September 23rd, 1806. And there was a rousing celebration. The whole town welcomed them with a monumental heroes reception. Lewis was back in good frame and finally resumed writing. Wrote a long letter to Thomas Jefferson. In it, he detailed an overview of their discoveries, adventures, and the safe return home. After the expedition's return, of course, the Corps was disbanded. And dubbed national heroes, the men of the expedition are paid well. And each was given 320 acres of land for his efforts. Some of the men got married and took up farming. Others returned to the frontier to trade fur and dig for gold. Sacagawea went east at Clark's invitation and let her son be raised by Clark. Went back to her village eventually and gave birth to a little girl. Shortly after that, she died from an unknown illness. William Clark was given a high position in government, but he quickly became bored. The only member of the expedition that wasn't rewarded fairly was William Clark's slave, whose name was York. Despite his help and commitment to the expedition, Clark refused to give York his freedom, which was the main thing he wanted. Now, today, looking back, it's possible to appreciate the far-reaching magnitude of Lewis and Clark's journey to the West. But at that time, Jefferson's goal was to find a river route that linked with the Pacific. And, of course, that didn't take place. His assumption that it would take Americans 100 generations out of the West was also wrong. Lewis and Clark's little trip opened the floodgates after the discovery of gold in California. The hoards were unleashed. The prairies turned into farms, and the buffalo were hunted to extinction, and Native Americans were killed, and survivors rounded up and put on reservations. And the white man's diseases eventually decimated the population of the Mandan, the Arikaras, and the Adatsa. The hospital tribes, whose friendliness and helpfulness were so crucial to Lewis and Clark's success. The explorers managed to an extraordinary feat of surviving a 6,000-mile excursion. And the ramifications of their trip would prove to be monumental. And, unfortunately, the West they traveled would never be the same. After resting and recuperating in St. Louis for a number of months, Lewis departed for Washington in the winter of 1807. Little did he know that the political atmosphere brewing in the heart of Washington would prove to be deadlier than any of the experiences he faced during the expedition. When he got to Washington, he was greeted again with a hero's welcome in both Washington and Philadelphia, became the toast of the town, and enjoyed his celebrity status. Returning to the familiarity of the White House, he was welcomed to the home of President Jefferson, whose conversations about the expedition, Lewis's personal thoughts and opinions on the discoveries were shared in detail. Now, Jefferson had always nurtured a spirit of exploration. Listen to Lewis's informative accounts as if the president himself had participated in the historical venture. And Lewis took the opportunity to obtain extra money and land grants for his men, and he was appointed governor of the extensive Louisiana Territory. His experience as a military officer and popularity he received from after the expedition made him a natural choice for that position. As Lewis prepared his journal for publication, he undoubtedly looked forward to his upcoming duties as governor, a job that would further develop his experience for what at the time seemed to point him to eventually calling the presidency his own. Regardless of how excited Lewis might have been about his future possibilities, though, he would soon be discouraged by all the political infighting that was taking place. Thrown into a hornet's nest that made the lands in the Louisiana Territory the original Wild Wild West. Now, it's important to recognize just how dangerous a time Lewis was living in. American Revolution had only been over for 30 years, and the newly formed U.S. was still in a relatively vulnerable position, subjected to the direction and edicts of its founders. In specific regard, the disagreements between Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson were at a fever pitch. They were famous potential rivals in almost everything. Jefferson was aware of Hamilton's allegiance to a nefarious cult the president believed was planning a takeover of the U.S. by creating a central bank that would control the country's currency. And Jefferson was suspicious of Hamilton's association with the Rothschilds, and he feared that Hamilton was going to betray not only him but the country. Now, it's no secret most of the founders were in the frequent company of Freemasons. And although he never claimed to be one himself, Jefferson visited Masonic temples and high-ranking Masonic friends such as Ben Franklin. And he used his access to acquire the knowledge he felt was going to be used against the founders by usurpers who were gearing up for a war. Now, both Lewis and Clark's were Masons as well. In fact, Lewis was known for achieving high rank among American Masons in almost record time. Lewis was elected to the Door of Virtue Lodge in January 1797 and climbed the ranks to pass Master Mason within 3 months. By 1799, he had attained status of Royal Archmason in the Widow's Son Lodge at Milton, Virginia. And it was shortly after that that Lewis was chosen by Jefferson to be his private secretary. Well, in September of 1808, after being named governor of the Louisiana Territory, Lewis helped establish the first Masonic Lodge in St. Louis, was named Master of St. Louis Lodge No. 111. And during his time as governor, Lewis was active in the lodge and shared duties with his most bitter rival, Frederick Bates, who was a close associate of famed traitor General James Wilkinson. Well, when Lewis left St. Louis on his trip, he gave his duties as the master to Bates, who later signed Clark's Masonic diploma, presumably after Clark had was encouraged to join the Masons by Lewis. Not a day. The so-called Illuminati have become the darlings of pop culture. But anyway, long ago, the mere mention of the word Illuminati in New World Order is enough to squash a prominent career, or even worse, get a person killed. The danger is even worse in the days of Meriwether Lewis, when the Illuminati infiltration into the very heart of the country was establishing very strong roots. Now, George Washington, the first president of the U.S., was personally indebted to the Rothschilds, who were instrumental in helping him obtain his position as a land surveyor. And Washington was not opposed to the foreign influence of the Illuminati, but he wrote cautionary letters about them. One of those letters was dated October 24, 1798, and according to what he wrote, it was not my intention to doubt the doctrines of the Illuminati and the principles of Jacobinism had not spread into the U.S. On the contrary, no one is more satisfied of this fact than I am. The idea I meant to convey was that I did not believe the lodges of Freemasons in this country had as societies endeavored to propagate the diabolical tenets of the first or pernicious principles of the latter. That individuals of them may have done it, or that founder or instruments employed have found the democratic societies of the U.S. may have had this object, and actually had a separation of the people from their government in view, is too evident to be questioned. In other words, Washington knew something was afoot. And this secret battle continued at the universities as well. July 4, 1812, Joseph Willard, then president of Harvard, gave a speech in Lancaster, New Hampshire, where he talked about secret societies and the Illuminati. Alexander Hamilton served as Secretary of the Treasury under George Washington from 1789 to 1795. And he learned a great deal about the banking system. And his knowledge helped him form the Federalist Party, primarily made up of bankers who advocated a strong central government. Man, they would lose their tiny little minds if they saw the government today. Naturally, the Anti-Federalists favored states' rights remained true to the original ideas fought for by the founders. Because Hamilton was a founder himself, he perceived betrayal as an even greater offense. Now, Jefferson was conscious of this and anticipated an eventual showdown with Hamilton. Before Jefferson was able to develop a strategy to handle Hamilton, the wheels of destruction began turning. Infamous House of Rothschild had its sights set on America. Now, it's difficult to unravel historical facts about the Rothschilds from the volumes of paranoid anti-Semitic agitprop that seemed to have been recycled continually since the 1800s. Put quite simply, the Rothschild banking family has been the source of an extraordinary amount of absurd propaganda. For centuries, proponents have promoted the idea that Jewish banking houses in Europe, and therefore the Jewish race, were responsible for manipulation of financial markets that led to the widespread and terrible poverty. And this theory has been used by politicians for centuries to woo populist voters and by modern authors to sell a lot of books to people who didn't know any better. Established by a goldsmith named Amschel Bauer in Frankfurt, Germany in 1743, this group of elite bankers had already managed to monopolize much of the wealth of Germany and England. And they succeeded by creating what we call today the fractional reserve banking. House of Rothschild learned fast that loaning money to people was small change. The real cash was to be made by loaning money to governments, ensuring the money would always be covered by public taxes. And Amschel Bauer was a pioneer in the art of dominating nations by gaining access to their banking institutions. You don't need to look any further than Amschel himself, who famously declared in 1790, "Let me issue and control the nation's money, and I don't care who writes the laws. I'll be in charge." 1700s, Britain was a powerful nation, sinking in massive amounts of debts. And this was in part attributed to the Rothschilds taking over local finance institutions, forming the Bank of England. And the House of Rothschild also developed plans to extract money from the American colonies. They control their own destinies by using colonial script as purchasing power. Now, the colonies weren't in debt to anybody or any entity. They were free from the Bank of England. And the powers that be were not happy with this, especially the English bankers. And through their privately owned Bank of England, they wrote the Currency Act of 1764 and forced Parliament to pass it. And although this was ever cited in any traditional history books, the Currency Act truly sparked a Revolutionary War. The Act made it illegal for the American colonies to print their own money. And even worse, it forced them to pay taxes to Britain in silver and gold. And this blow by the bankers ended the growing economic success the colonies were experiencing through the independent trade and forced the eventual showdown over what became known as taxation without representation. And for the very first time, the founders were forced to consider raising arms against the crown. Ben Franklin wrote about it in his autobiography. Now, Britain wasn't worried about fighting a war with America. The British government reasoned it could be an easy victory. But what it wasn't counting on was America's use of guerrilla warfare tactics learned from the Native Americans. With a little help from the French Navy, the colonists shook the world by defeating the British Army. But not before George Washington was tricked into taking a loan from somebody he trusted. While the war was on the verge of being lost, Washington borrowed from fellow founder Alexander Hamilton. For his part, Hamilton was acting as a Rothschild agent. And this one shrewd move essentially won the war for the bankers. When the war was over and the colonies were granted independence, with Hamilton's maneuvering, the House of Rothschild already had its proverbial foot in the door. After the war, there was a huge debt to be paid, and Hamilton wasted no time in setting up the first bank of the U.S. in 1791. This happened shortly after Ben Franklin died. The bank was privately owned and secretly belonged to the Rothschild Consortium. Ben Franklin understood the dangers of a privately owned central bank controlling the issuance of the country's currency. Now, Jefferson, for his part, disagreed with Hamilton strongly about a national bank, believing it would acquire too much power over the government. He said at the time he considered a private bank issuing public currency and the creation of a perpetual national debt to be more of a threat to America than any army. And he was right. Hamilton, for his part, especially based on the fact that he was working for him, thought the opposite, convinced banks would play a vital role in America's future. His main support for his position was declaring it was better to have American banks doing the lending than British banks. Of course, he never mentioned the same people who owned the banks of England had made the move to own the first American bank as well. In addition to their quarrels over the banking, Hamilton and Jefferson disagreed on the projected path of American future. Jefferson believed that liberty and freedom were the greatest virtues society could have, and that the nation would have to be sustained by an agrarian society made up of independent farmers. Hamilton thought Jefferson's view was outdated and was convinced that an agricultural economy would keep America poor. Hamilton and the folks he worked for were not interested in being peaceful farmers. They wanted to build nations into world powers sustained by trade and manufacturing. Jefferson faced a tremendous challenge in keeping America safe from Hamilton. Hamilton wanted to install an American king and even created the concept of implied powers that was clause used to cover any governmental action not enumerated in the Constitution. Through the Federalist Party, Hamilton had infiltrated all branches of the government and gained a near monopoly over the judicial system. Dedicated to achieving a simple goal, Hamilton wanted to increase the federal government's power over the states. Now, this was not a popular position, and the voters said no time after time. And even though Hamilton suffered electoral defeat after defeat, he wasn't discouraged and knew the original plans were being carried out clandestinely. Well, However successful Hamilton was in gaining access to and control over America's newly formed government, it wouldn't last long for him. Aaron Burr killed Hamilton in what is now the most famous duel in American history. With the death of Hamilton, Jefferson had one less enemy to worry about. But Hamilton's death caused mass commotion and hysteria as Burr, Jefferson's disgraced vice president, went on the lam. Less well known as an advocate and an agent for the British central banking advocates was Nicholas Biddle. He was a lawyer, publisher, financier, and at the vanguard of America's efforts to establish a central banking system. Biddle was every bit as responsible as Hamilton for founding the first bank of the U.S. When the first bank's charter expired, it was revived and led by Biddle until Andrew Jackson vetoed its charter, leading to its implosion in 1843. Jackson was another who believed the future of America was in jeopardy, thanks to the influence of foreign banking interests such as the Rothschilds. Well, all this was... going on. News began to circulate in the colonial streets that the seemingly crazed General James Wilkinson was gearing up for an invasion of Mexico. Triumphs of Lewis and Clark faded from public consciousness as news of Wilkinson's plan spread. Growing up poor, Wilkinson had joined the American Revolutionary Army, and owing to his reckless bravado and cunning, he became a general at the age of 20. Never seemed to care about the ideals he was supposed to be fighting for, but he did seem particularly interested in getting paid, as most people are. That attitude didn't sit well with the other founders, but the general was tolerated because he was considered a great commander and a charismatic leader. None of the founders really trusted him, but they kept him around out of loyalty. He would eventually lead the army longer than any general of his era, but his oversized ego and lofty ambitions outgrew his duties to his country. He'd become a land speculator and, through his newly acquired connections, acted as a spy and conspired with Spanish agents concerning the lands along the Mississippi. His treachery... Double dealing wasn't fully realized till Spanish-American War, when U.S. troops captured the Spanish archives in Cuba. In those archives, they found astonishing information regarding Wilkinson's role as an agent working for Spain. Then after the Spanish left the picture, Wilkinson devised a new plot with Vice President Aaron Burr to organize an unofficial invasion of Texas. His plans failed to manifest again and again as the playing field changed overnight due to events in Europe and the Louisiana Purchase. Now, Spain could no longer pay attention to the colonies thanks to Napoleon's invasion, but when one door closes, another one opens up. At least that happened for Wilkinson, who after the Louisiana Purchase was appointed governor of the new territory by President Thomas Jefferson. While serving as governor, Wilkinson sent secret reconnaissance missions deep into Texas territory. He was looking for gold and new routes to Mexico. He planned to invade and overthrow the Spanish with or without support from Congress, needed all the resources he could get. And he knew one way of getting the bullets he needed was to secure the large lead mines found south of St. Louis. Now, Congress felt the immense fortune to be made in lead mining operations south of St. Louis would pay for the Louisiana Purchase within 5 years. But the land speculators had been conniving with the Spanish for control of the mines weren't about to give them up so easily. It conveniently happened the man appointed to govern these mines for the U.S. was the treacherous General Wilkinson. His right-hand man was another chief troublemaker for President Jefferson. Probably the most feared man in the territory, John Smith, was an aggressive land swindler looking to acquire all the lead mines he came across. He is reputed to have killed 15 men in duels and always carried 4 pistols, a bowie knife, and a rifle. He'd provide the remaining lead needed for Wilkinson's invasion of Mexico, but before they could take the move, Jefferson removed Wilkinson from his gubernatorial duties. Now, Wilkinson, of course, was furious over his demotion after the capture of Aaron Burr. Fingers being pointed at Wilkinson's direction as a co-conspirator. Wilkinson's removal and the government's subsequent clampdown on the mines left the Louisiana territories in a chaotic state. Crime and corruption were everywhere, and the whole area needed to be cleaned out. And that was the obstacle facing Lewis as he prepared to succeed Wilkinson as the new governor in Louisiana. But Lewis was idealistic and optimistic and reportedly looked forward to taking out the trash corrupting the Louisiana territory. He still hadn't finished that job even today. Strangely, Lewis fell silent for an extended period, must have dismayed Jefferson and others who waited the publication of his journals. There have been various theories that have come out regarding that delay, including that Lewis was given time to recuperate by Jefferson, that he was actively searching for a wife, he fell victim to alcoholism, disease, or some other debilitation. Scholars generally concede that a clear answer to what happened to Lewis during this period is unlikely to ever emerge. The mysterious delay also resulted in scores of volumes of the journals going missing. Gary Moulton, professor and editor of one volume of the published journals of Lewis and Clark, suggests throughout the years growing evidence indicates that much of what Lewis and Clark wrote about the West disappeared. Well, when the journal entries, what the journal entries contain, what truths they may have revealed about the fate of their author, certainly remains a mystery. Another strange anomaly that has come to light are the mysterious gaps in Lewis's journal, which are extensive and have vexed scholars for over 200 years. He made no journal entries during the first portion of the journey, for example, from May 14, 1804 until April 7, 1805, when the Corps left Fort Mandan. This nearly year-long gap during what could have been an enthusiastic beginning is especially curious. Some speculate Lewis was taking field notes or keeping personal journals that he planned to transfer to official notebooks later, and his collection of unofficial inscriptions was lost. Letters from Lewis to Jefferson suggest some kind of journals were kept during the stay at Fort Mandan. Lewis, for example, mentioned a correct copy of a journal that he intended to send back to Washington prior to departing from Fort Mandan. Later, he sent another letter to Jefferson promising a proper journal be delivered by canoe to an outpost on the Missouri River. Unfortunately, no journal has ever been found. Now, some other sets of writings did materialize, however, list of herb specimens, mineral deposits, geologic features, astronomical observations, and things like that. Some of these notes are attributed to other members of the party and are considered collaborative efforts between Lewis and Clark, who may have decided to stray from Jefferson's explicit instructions. They both keep detailed and extensive records. Others speculate that some of Lewis's journals were lost at various points along the journey. One theory suggests that Lewis's early writings were lost along with Clark's during a sudden storm that rocked the vessel the Corps was traveling in shortly after departing Fort Mandan. Now, Clark's notes were known to be lost, but no mentions made of Lewis or his journals during that incident. Other gaps include time on the Ohio-Missouri rivers from September 19th and November 11th, 1803, and stretched from November 28, 1803 until May 14, 1804. And inconsistent entries from April 26, 1805 to January 1, 1806. And a long stretch from April 13, 1806 to the end of the journey. In total, there are more than 400 days of entries missing from Lewis's journals between May of 1804 and September of 1806. Only the gap beginning April 13th after Lewis mysteriously shot in the thigh is a plausible and evident explanation. Though it's rarely mentioned in historical accounts of the journey, most scholars involved in collecting and editing and publishing the journals of the Corps of Discovery concluded tales of the journey are crafted from a convoluted patchwork of documents. Field notes, field journals, notebooks, diary writing, scraps of paper, other various records, and a great deal of conjecture and supposition. At least eight men on the trip are believed to have kept records. Lewis, Clark, Privates Joseph Whitehouse, and Robert Frazier, Sergeants Patrick Glass, John Ordway, Charles Floyd, and Nathaniel Pryor. And all but Ordway returned only partial records of the journey. Clark missed 9 days in February of 1805 while hunting for game. Gass's original journal went missing before a controversial and paraphrased version of it was published in 1807. And though it's assumed he kept some kind of records, no evidence of any documents prior to recorded by Pryor ever appeared. Floyd kept regular entries till he died in April 20th, 1804. Private Whitehouse's diary had several gaps and terminates without explanation November 6, 1805. Ordway kept the most consistent records regarding the events of the day, but didn't keep extensive scientific records. And curiously, Lewis's diaries are not included among the works compiled to create the tale of Lewis and Clark's great journey. During a time when the journals had been compiled and prepared for publication, correspondence between Jefferson and Clark and one of the first editors of the Corps Collective Journey, Nicholas Biddle, mentioned no concern about Lewis's missing diaries. It is important to note at the time that Biddle has not yet embroiled in efforts to revive America's central bank, but was likely already in bed with the Rothschilds and the Federalists. And despite a preponderance of missing documents, stories of the Corps began circulating in 1806 via newspapers, word of mouth, and government documents, including Jefferson's first report to Congress about the journey. In 1808, with the help of schoolteacher David McKeon, the journals of Patrick Gass were published amid public and private protests by Lewis. Now, Biddle was the first to publish an authorized official account of the journey kept by Lewis and, journals kept by Lewis and Clark, although a paraphrased narrative and not an edited reprinting of the journals. Biddle was chosen by Clark and several advisors to take on the task, and Clark conceded it wasn't literate enough to complete. At the time, Biddle was a young Philadelphia lawyer, editor, and publisher, and was considered to be qualified to take on the massive project. At first, Biddle refused a job offered to him by Clark, but later convinced by one of Lewis's mentors, botanist Benjamin Smith Barton, to accept the assignment. With the help of Clark, Biddle began work on the project in 1810, supplementing the collective remaining journals of the Corps with face-to-face interviews with Clark, who provided a wealth of additional material from memory during interviews conducted in Fincastle, Virginia. Well, it's interesting to note that we don't even know if the information published was accurate or complete. If they found evidence of a pre-existing society, then we didn't have the authority to take that land. The legal authority, that is. Well, on that note, we come to the end of today's show. We'll be back tomorrow. And once again, you'll be listening to Ken Hudnall and the Ken Hudnall Show. And hopefully I won't be sneezing. Until then, y'all have a great evening.